Last time we talked about one of the linear differential operators, the gradient. And just to remind you, I told you it's useful to think of the gradient as a machine. The machine takes as input a scalar function of position and it outputs a vector function of position. Today, we're going to discuss the other two linear operators, the divergence and the curl, in that order. The divergence is a little bit more difficult than the gradient, and the curl is the most difficult one of all. And again, I think it's useful to think of the divergence as a machine. The divergence takes as its input a vector function of position, and the output is a scalar function of position. So in some ways, it's dual to the gradient. I called this new scalar function of position S instead of T because I don't want you to get to thinking that you start with a scalar function T, you run it through the gradient machine and get a vector function V, and then pass that vector function V through the divergence and get the same scalar function back. You don't. You get a scalar function, but it's a different scalar function. So I gave it a different name, S. Written in terms of the Noblis symbol, this is the same symbol that's used for the gradient. In the gradient, you just place this next to the scalar function. But now in the divergence, you take the dot product of the nabla with the vector function v. This is the same dot product that you have met before in your intro math and physics courses. And in this notation, this would say del dot v is s, or the divergence of v is the scalar function s. Another notation, especially in older books, is to write the word div, short for divergence, out in front. No vector sign over this because the divergence gives you a scalar function out, not a vector function out. All right, as usual in Cartesian coordinates, it's easiest to see. So what is the divergence of V, or what is del dot V in Cartesian coordinates, X, Y, Z? Well, I'm going to take the partial derivative with respect to X of something, but the something is the X component of the vector field V. So this kind of looks like the gradient. Let's go back to the other slide for a second. It looks similar to the same operation. Here in the gradient, I'm taking the x derivative with respect to something, but in the gradient, I'm taking the x derivative of the scalar function t, and furthermore, after I'm done, I'm multiplying it by the unit vector e sub x hat. Now in the divergence, I'm taking the x derivative of only the x component of v, and there is no ex hat out in front. There's no unit vector out in front. And then do the same thing in the y direction. Take the partial derivative with respect to y, holding x and z fixed, of the y component of v, and then finally take the z derivative of the z component of the vector field z. And then add all those together, and no hats, no unit vectors anywhere on the right-hand side. And so this is in fact a scalar. Everything in the blue box is that scalar function that I called S above. Here's an example with made up functions. So let's say the vector function of position V of R is the following. It's EX hat times this. And so sine of X would be what I was calling V of X. V of X is everything, not including the EX hat. So V of X can be a function of X, Y, and Z. This one that I chose just happens to be a function of X alone. Could have included Y and Z dependence if I wished. And then the Y component of V is everything multiplying EY hat. So VY is just this, Z squared Y. This happens to depend on Z and Y and not X, but I could have put an X in there if I wished. And then finally, the Z component of the vector field V is everything multiplying EZ hat, and so V sub Z is just this. It's the exponential of X times Y. It happens not to depend on Z, but it, like I said, it could have. All right, let's take the divergence of this vector function V. So what I'm supposed to do is take the partial derivative with respect to X of V sub X, treating Y and Z as if they were constants. So that means I need to take the derivative with respect to X of sine X, and I don't have to worry about y and z because there are none in this first term. The derivative of sine is cosine. And no unit vector out in front when you take the divergence. Next, I'm supposed to take the derivative, partial derivative with respect to y of v sub y. So that means I need to take the partial derivative with respect to y of the quantity z squared times y, treating z and x like a constant. Well, there is no x, but treat z like a constant. And so if z squared is a constant and you take the derivative of z squared y with respect to y, you'll just get z squared by itself. And then finally, I have to take the partial derivative with respect to z of the z component of the velocity, holding x and y fixed. But if I hold x and y fixed and they're constants, then e to the xy is a constant. And when I take the derivative of the exponential e to the xy with respect to z, that's the derivative with respect to z of a constant, that's nothing, that's zero. And then add those three together. No unit vectors in sight. There's no ex hat, ey hat, ez hat. And that sum is what I was calling the scalar function s. So cosine of x plus z squared. In generalized coordinates, the divergence is much more difficult, and you don't have to memorize this. I'm going to say that frequently throughout this lecture. Don't memorize. Whenever you need it, you can look it up. This is the formula in generalized coordinates. You can see the scale factors, the h's appearing again. So out in front, there's 1 divided by the product of h1, h2, and h3. And then inside square brackets, there are 3 terms. The first one looks like this. This is the partial derivative with respect to q1, holding q2 and q3 fixed of this, the product of the one component of the vector field, which can depend on q1, q2, and q3, the h2 scale factor, which can depend on q1, q2, and q3, and finally multiplied by h3 scale factor, which again can depend on q1, q2, and q3. So a common question that I usually get when I show this is, why don't you just cancel this h2 and h3 in the numerator with this h2 and h3 in the denominator? And the answer is you can't do that in general because of this fact, because h2 could depend on the coordinates and h3 could depend on all three coordinates. And in particular, if h2 and h3 depend on q1, then you have to take the derivative with respect to q1 first of this quantity in parentheses. And only then, after you're done taking the derivative, then you can divide by h1, h2, and h3. So in general, the h2 and the h3 in the denominator do not cancel the h2 and the h3 inside the parentheses. And then you repeat. So in the second term, you take the partial derivative with respect to q2, holding q1 and q3 fixed, of the quantity, the 2 component of the vector field, times the h3 scale factor times the h1 scale factor. And again, all three of these, the v2, the h3, the h1, they could all be functions of the generalized coordinates, q1, q2, and q3. So first you have to take the derivative, then you can divide by the scale factors out in front. And again, there's no cancellation. And then finally, repeat for the third component, take the partial derivative with respect to q3, holding q1 and q2 fixed, of this quantity, the 3 component of the vector field, which could depend on coordinates, the h1 scale factor, which depends on coordinates, and the h2 scale factor, which depends on coordinates. Okay, so that was a lot of words. Here's what it looks like in spherical polar coordinates. This is the divergence of the vector field written as a function of r, theta, and phi. So that's q1 is r, q2 is theta, q3 is phi. And again, I don't recommend memorizing this. Do what everybody does. When you need it, you look it up. The important thing is that on the right-hand side, there are no unit vectors in sight. There is no er hat, there's no e theta hat, there's no e phi hat. So this is a scalar function on the right-hand side. That's what I was calling S of R, scalar function of position. All right, again, to show you how useful it is to use a different coordinate system sometimes, let's take this example. Here is a vector field written in coordinate free notation. So the vector field of coordinates r vector is this. This is arbitrary, I just chose one. So in the numerator, there is an r vector, and in the denominator, there is the length of the r vector quantity squared. So that's my vector field. If I translate this into Cartesian coordinates, I use the fact that ex times x plus EY times Y plus EZ times Z is exactly R vector. And then the denominator, the magnitude of the R vector would be the square root of X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared, but I'm squaring that. And so the square root goes away and you simply get X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared for all three denominators. All right, let's take the divergence of this vector function in Cartesian coordinates. Again, this is going to be so cumbersome. I don't want to do all three terms. Let's just do the X term, and you'll see by symmetry the Y and the Z terms look similar. So I need to take, let me scroll up a little bit. I need to take the partial derivative with respect to X of V sub X, the X component of the vector field. The X component of the vector field is that thing that multiplies E sub X. So this in the box, that's V sub X. And I need to take the partial derivative with respect to X holding Y and Z fixed of that. Well, I need the product rule. So first I'll take the derivative of the X in the numerator. The derivative of X with respect to X is just one. And then I leave the denominator alone. And in the next term, I leave the X in the numerator alone. So one of these two X's is the original X in the numerator. And then I need to take the derivative of the denominator. Well, that's X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared to the negative one power. When you take the derivative, you get negative. And then the function back again, but I have to decrement the exponent by one. So it was originally something to the minus one power. Now it's something to the minus two power, and then I have to use the chain rule and go inside and take the derivative of this expression with respect to X, and that's 2x. So the negative sign is coming from the negative one exponent over here. One of these two x's is the original x in the numerator, and then the other factor of 2x is coming from the derivative of the x squared in the denominator. If I put both of these terms over the same denominator, that will be the quantity X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared, and then the whole thing raised to the two power. And do a little bit of algebra, it cleans off to this. So it's minus X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared in the numerator. So you can see, because we were looking at the X component, it's the X component that picks up a negative sign. And if you want to, you can go through, do it the long way for the Y components, or you can just realize that in the Y components, the y squared term will pick up a negative sign. In the z components, the z term will pick up a negative sign. Now I'm supposed to add these three terms together. So add this red one to these two blue ones. And again, more algebra, more cancellation. And you find in the numerator, you'll get x squared plus y squared plus z squared to the one power. In the denominator, that same function, but raised to the two power. And so you can cancel one of the powers and you'll get simply one over X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared to the one power. But then you recognize this combination, that's exactly the length of the position vector squared. And so that's one over the modulus of R quantity squared. Okay, that was a lot of work. Now let me show you how much simpler it is in spherical polar coordinates. I need to express this function, which is currently in coordinate free form. I need to write that as something times ER hat plus something times E theta hat plus something times E phi hat. But if you remember, R vector divided by one copy of R magnitude is ER hat. And so the thing that goes in the first blank here, multiplying ER hat, that's simply one over R. And there are no other vectors. There is no E theta hat and there is no E phi hat. And so the things that go in the blanks next to those unit vectors are just zero. So this is a vector field of position, but it only has one component. It only has an R component. It doesn't have a polar component, doesn't have an azimuthal component. Okay, when I take the divergence of this vector field, I scroll back up to the form that's appropriate for spherical polar coordinates, this one. But V theta is zero, so that term gets knocked out. And V sub phi, the azimuthal component, is zero. So that term gets knocked out. And really, I just have the first one. And then furthermore, since VR is 1 over r. There is no theta. There is no phi. I can write, instead of this partial derivative with respect to r, I can just use the full derivative with respect to r. So that's what I've done down here. This is the form from the general formula that's just copied. And now I replace this v sub r is this thing that multiplies er hat 1 over r. So I put that in. And I'm supposed to multiply by r squared first, then take the derivative with respect to r, and then finally divide by 1 over r squared. All right, so let's do that. 1 over r times r squared is just r. And the derivative of r with respect to r, well, that's day one of calculus one. The derivative of r with respect to r is just 1. And then finally, when you're done taking the derivative, you divide by 1 over r squared. And so the answer is 1 over r squared. But that's the same. That's the same as what we got above. 1 over the magnitude of r vector squared is exactly 1 over the spherical coordinate r quantity squared. But again, I did in two lines what it took me two-thirds of a page to do in Cartesian coordinates. So I hope I'm showing you the power of using different coordinate systems depending on the job you have to do. All right, one application of this in math and in physics is a theorem that has many names. So this is called the divergence theorem because it involves the divergence of a vector field. But it's also called the Gauss theorem. It's also called the Ostrogradsky theorem, and it's called the Gauss-Ostrogradsky theorem. So good ideas have many parents, and this is evidence of that old adage. You don't want to be the first to discover something. You want to be the last to discover something because that person gets his or her name attached to it. And now to explain what this is, I need to use a different V. Here, I put a bar through the V for volume. So this V with a slash through it is volume. Here's another volume. This V written without a bar through it is our vector field. There are too many Vs. I didn't want things to get confusing. And the divergence theorem says the following. If you perform the three-dimensional integral of the divergence of some vector field of position, and you integrate that over an open volume V, I'll explain what open means in a second, then on the right-hand side, you get the double integral over the closed surface S. I'll explain what closed means in a second as well. Of the same vector field that you had in here where you were taking the divergence, but now don't take the divergence, just simply take that vector field and dot it into a little area vector and then integrate that over the surface that bounds the volume. So let's explain things. There are three integral signs here because this dv will have three coordinates in it. If you're in Cartesian coordinates, dv is simply the product of dx times dy times dz. In another system like spherical polar coordinates, the dv would be r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi. But both of them have three coordinates. This depends on x, y, and z. And here the measure depends on r, theta, and phi. So each one of those infinitesimals, each one of those d somethings, gets its own integral sign. So three integrals over here. On the right-hand side, this is a two-dimensional integral over area. So if you were in Cartesian coordinates and you were looking at a plane of constant z, like z equals 0 or z equals 3 or z equals pi, then the d area would just be dx dy. If you were integrating instead over a plane of constant x, like x equals 2, then d area would be dy dz. But they both have two coordinates in them, either x and y or y and z, or for that matter, x and z. If you were doing an integral in spherical coordinates over a shell of constant r, then there would be an r sine theta d phi. So that looks like the volume measure dv, except there's no dr. This dr over here in the dv is missing. There is no dr in the area. So this is an integral over two coordinates, theta and phi. So again, all of these areas on the right-hand side are integrals over two coordinates and therefore two integral signs. Okay, what does this word open mean and what does this word closed mean? I'll give you the physics definition. There's a rigorous mathematical definition involving set theory. We don't need the full power of that in physics, an open region means there's an edge. And so if you imagine that that this is a blob of water, and you're a fish swimming around in here, there's a boundary. If you try to go out of the bubble, you'll find yourself in water on one side and then out of water on the other side. And so if you have to cross a boundary like that, that volume is called open. So open in physics, open means that this thing has a boundary. This ring through the integral signs tells you that that surface is closed. And again, I'll give you the physics definition. Closed means there is no boundary. So now imagine that that this is a balloon and you're an ant walking around on the surface. No matter where you go, you'll never hit an edge. You can go all the way around the surface. The surface does not have a boundary, and so it is called closed. I should warn you, in English, open and closed are antonyms. And so, for example, a door can either be open or closed, but not both. But not so in mathematics. In set theory, you can have sets that are both open and closed, and sets like that are called clopen. That's a portmanteau of closed and open, clopen. All right, but I don't want to go too far afield. We don't need all that machinery for this course. But the notation is the closed surface S, the surface S that has no boundary, is itself the boundary of the open volume V, and that is written this way. Another notation to denote boundary is to use this curly D. So this is saying that the surface S is the boundary of the open volume V, and that's rewritten here. The surface S is the boundary of the open volume V. This line is telling you that S has no boundary. Or in other words, the boundary of the boundary of the volume is equal to zero. And that's always true. If you take any manifold M, any dimension manifold that you like, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to infinity, the boundary of the boundary of anything is always going to be zero. Here's another example, one dimension lower. So over here, the shaded region was a three-dimensional open volume. The boundary was a two-dimensional closed surface S. One dimension lower, this disk is an open surface. And so if you were an ant walking around on the surface, you would eventually hit the boundary. You can tell here I'm on the disk and here I'm not on the disk. And so there's a distinct boundary. That means this surface S is open, has a boundary. But if you were an insect walking around on this one-dimensional closed curve C, you could go around and around and you would never hit a boundary. So C doesn't have any edge. An edge for a line would be a point. So you never hit the boundary. C itself is therefore closed. So that's written this way. C is the boundary of the open surface S, and the boundary of C is zero because that's the boundary of the boundary of S, and the boundary of the boundary of anything is equal to zero. Here's a line segment in one dimension that does have a boundary. So that point on the right and that point on the left form the boundary of the line segment, and this is therefore an open one-dimensional manifold C, an open curve. Okay, and that's enough topology. We don't need any more. The last vector operation is the curl, and like I said, it's the most complicated one. The curl, if you think of the curl as a machine, the curl will take as its input one vector field, so you'll have to feed it three components, the 1, 2, and 3 components of the vector field, and the output will be three components of another vector field. So it takes a vector field in, and it produces another different vector field out. So I call the input vector field V, the output vector field W. Written in more standard notation, it looks like this. There's that same nabla symbol, the same one that's used in the gradient, the same one that's used in the divergence. In the divergence, we took the dot product of the nabla with some vector field. Now we're going to take the cross product of the nabla or the del with some vector field V, and the output is a different vector field W. In older books, the curl has a different notation. Instead of del vector cross something, you would just write the word curl, and there should be a vector sign over this, so include a vector sign over the curl because the output is a vector. And sometimes it's symbolized ROT. That's short for rotation. When I draw the vector field on the bottom of the page, you'll see why the word rotation is important. And again, to be really correct, you should include a vector sign over that. Or if you were typesetting a book, you would write both a curl and ROT in boldface to indicate that they were vectors. Okay, let's start with Cartesian because it's the simplest example, and even this will be complicated enough. The curl of some vector field V in Cartesian coordinates is the following. These vertical lines represent that you should take the determinant of whatever is between them. So this is a matrix. These are not multiplied together. These are nine entries of a 3x3 matrix. The top row are the unit vectors, EX hat, EY hat, EZ hat. The middle row of the matrix is partial derivative with respect to X, partial with respect to Y, partial with respect to Z. And then the third row of the matrix is the X component of the vector field, which can depend on X, Y, and Z. The Y component of the vector field, which can depend on X, Y, and Z. And finally, the Z component of the vector field, which can depend on X, Y, and Z. And so you're supposed to take the determinant of this 3x3 matrix, but it's important that you do it in a special order so that the operators, the partial derivatives in the second row, need to act on the things in the third row. They don't act on the unit vectors in the first row, they act down, they act on the third row. All right, so let me rewrite this determinant. I'll use the method of cofactors, and so you probably saw this in your linear algebra course. So here's a real life application. I'm going to expand around the first row. And so the first element in the first row is E sub X, that's copied down right here. And then you're supposed to strike out the first column containing EX and strike out the first row containing EX, and then take this the determinant of this 2x2 matrix that remains. So I've copied that over here. There's the 2x2 matrix with the first row and first column missing. And again, these vertical lines mean take the determinant of whatever is inside. And out in front, there's a factor of one. There's a parity. You have to be careful when you expand using the method of cofactors. The sign is always negative one to the row plus column. And so because this E sub X is in the first row, first column, this is minus one squared, or simply one. But when I expand around the second entry in the first row, the E sub Y, which is copied down here, this is in the first row, second column, and so there's a factor of minus one to the one plus two, and minus one cubed is minus one, so the middle term picks up a negative sign. And then again, you're going to strike out the first row containing EY, you're going to strike out the middle column containing EY, and that leaves you with this partial with respect to X, partial with respect to Z, V sub X and V sub Z, and I copy that 2x2 matrix down here. And again, the vertical lines on either side tell you to take the determinant of that 2x2 matrix. And then finally, I have the last term in the first row. That's EZ, so I copy that here. It's in the first row, third column, and so the parity factor is minus one to the one plus three, minus one to the fourth power is just plus one. And again, you're going to strike out the first row containing EZ, strike out the last column containing EZ, and what's left is this 2x2 submatrix, which I've copied over here, and then take the determinant of that. You can see this is Cartesian. This is the easiest system, and it's still very complicated, but we're almost done. And so what happens to the first term? Well, the first term is proportional to E sub X. There it is. And then when I take the determinant, I have to make sure that the operators, the partial derivative operators, are acting on the functions. And so the first term is along the main diagonal. It's d by dy of vz. So that's this term right here with a plus sign. And then I have to subtract the other diagonal, but I have to make sure that the operator is first. And so it's d by dz acting on v sub y, and then with a negative sign in front. And then do that for the second term. Main diagonal with a plus sign, other diagonal with a minus sign, main diagonal with a plus sign, other diagonal with a minus sign, and you wind up getting these six terms. And I'm afraid that's as simple as it gets. So again, when you need it, you look it up in a book. All right, let's do an example. Suppose that the vector function of coordinates x, y, z is the following. We'll make it really simple. So it'll be minus y in the x hat direction, plus x in the y hat direction, and no z component. So 0 times e z hat. If I want to take the curl of this function, I need to use the determinant that I wrote above. And so the first row are the unit vectors ex, ey, and ec. Even though the ez is missing, you need to include it in the first row so that this matrix is 3 by 3. The next row are the partial derivatives. I started using a more condensed notation. So this partial sub x means d by dx. This means d by dy. This means d by dz. And then the third row is supposed to be the components of the vector field, v sub x, v sub y, v sub z. Well, v sub x is everything multiplying e sub x hat, so that's minus y. That goes in this first entry here. That's this, v sub x. V sub y is everything multiplying e sub y hat, so v sub y is simply x. And the thing multiplying e z hat is 0. And so I put the 0 in the third entry down there. Now I need to take that determinant. But it simplifies. So the first term, let's look up here. The first term would be e sub x hat times this. Partial with respect to y of vz, but that's partial with respect to y of 0. So that term gets knocked out. And then minus partial with respect to z of v sub y, but that's partial with respect to z of x, but that's 0. So ex gets multiplied by 0 minus 0, which is nothing. The next term is minus ey hat, so there it is, minus ey hat, partial of vz with respect to x, but vz is 0, so that term gets knocked out, that's equal to 0, minus partial of vx with respect to z, but vx is negative y, and the partial of negative y with respect to z is 0. So again, it's minus ey hat times 0 minus 0, which is nothing. So two components of the curl got knocked out. The last one is ez hat times this, partial of vy with respect to x minus the partial of vx with respect to y. So that's d by dx of v sub y, which is x, but this is easy, dx by dx is just 1. And then minus the partial with respect to y of vx, but vx is minus y, and so the two minus signs cancel, that one and that one cancel, and the partial of y with respect to y again is 1, and so you get 1 plus 1 or 2. So the answer is the curl of this vector field v is just 2 times ez hat. That's the curl. This curl happens not to depend on x, y, and z. For a more complicated vector function v, this would depend on x, y, and z, but this one is so simple. That is just, it's just 2 ez hat. If I plot this vector field v in the xy plane, it will look like the following. So let's try a couple of points. What about the origin? The origin is x equals 0, y equals 0. If you plug in x equals 0 and y equals 0, you'll just get nothing. And so there is no vector at the origin. How about over here? This point is x equals 1, y equals 0. Well, if x equals 1 and y is equal to 0, then v will just be 1 times ey hat. And so I drew that as a vector of length 1 pointing in the y direction. And how about here? This is x equals 0, y equals 1. Well, if x equals 0, this term gets knocked out. If y is equal to plus 1, then the answer is minus 1 ex. So I drew a little vector of length 1 in the negative x direction. And you can pick a few more points around the plane until you get an idea of what's happening. And it looks like water spiraling down a drain. If you were looking down on the drain, this is how the water would be spiraling. This field happens to be counterclockwise, but that's by my choice. But the idea is if you put a wind vane in here, if you put something with paddles on it, anywhere in the field, the paddles would begin to turn counterclockwise. And so you can think of that as a curl meter. Put a four-veined paddle anywhere in the vector field, and if it looks like it's going to get pushed around by the vectors and begin rotating, then there is a non-zero curl. The handle of the curl meter would point out of the page toward you, and that's in the z direction. So you can't tell that you're going to get a constant 2, but I can tell that it's going to be in the positive z direction because of this counterclockwise rotation of the field. That's why another symbol for the curl is ROT, rotation, because it looks like you have velocity vectors going around in a cyclone rotating. Okay, here is the curl written in all of its glory or all of its ugliness in generalized coordinates. So if V, the vector field, is a function of Q1, Q2, and Q3 generalized coordinates, and you take the curl of that vector field, you get the following. Here are the scale factors appearing again. So outside, the product of H1, H2, and H3. The first line are the unit vectors multiplied by their respective scale factors. The second line is the partial derivatives with respect to the generalized coordinates. And the last line is the vector field components multiplied by their respective scale factors. So V1, H1, V2, H2, V3, H3. Remember, both the V and the H can depend on the coordinates Q1, Q2, and Q3. So first you need to take the derivatives in the second line, and then you can divide by them outside. There is no cancellation in general. Okay. Again, when you need it, you look up the formula. In spherical polar coordinates, the scale factors are HR is equal to 1, H theta is equal to R, and H phi is equal to R sine theta. And so I've given you one of the forms for the curl in spherical polar coordinates. I haven't carried out this determinant, so you need to expand this. Again, use the method of cofactors. There'll be two terms that go along with the ER, two more that go along with E theta, two more that go along with E phi, and so six terms altogether. I didn't feel like writing it. When you need it, look it up in a book. There is an analog to the divergence theorem or Gauss's theorem or the Ostrogradsky theorem, but one dimension lower. So let me scroll up back to the divergence theorem. Over here on the left-hand side of the divergence theorem, we had an open volume, and then on the right-hand side, a closed manifold one dimension lower. So this was a three-dimensional open volume, and on the right-hand side, this was a two-dimensional closed surface. Here I had the divergence of V on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, just V itself. Okay, now let's look at Stokes' theorem, which is also used in physics, especially in electrostatics. On the left-hand side, I have an open surface S, that is to say a surface with a boundary. And on the right-hand side, I have a closed manifold one dimension lower. So this is a closed one-dimensional manifold, a closed curve like this. So this surface S is open because it has a boundary. The boundary is the curved C. But if you're an insect walking around on the curved C, you never come to an edge. You never hit a dead end point. And so the curve C is therefore closed. And Stokes' theorem says, if you take the double integral over the open surface S of the curl of some vector field V dotted into D area, remember the curl of anything is another vector, so I have to take this vector in square brackets and take the dot product with a little area vector dA. On the right-hand side, that will give me the same V that I put in here, but no curl, and simply dot that V into a little line element DL. Here's a little DL shown around the curve, and then just integrate around the boundary of the curve. So both the divergence theorem and Stokes' theorem are useful because you can convert what used to be a three-dimensional integral. Here I have to integrate over the interior of this region. All of these points inside constitute the open volume V. That's a lot of points over which to integrate, but I can get the same answer by integrating over this two-dimensional manifold. I just have to integrate over the closed surface, this balloon that encloses the volume, and it's easier to do a two-dimensional integral than it is to do a three-dimensional integral. Stokes' theorem has the same idea, but instead of doing a two-dimensional integral where I have to integrate over all these points inside the red region S, that's a two-dimensional integral, I can get the same answer by doing a one-dimensional integral just around the curve on the outside, and usually that's a whole lot easier. So you can convert a harder problem into an easier problem. All right. And that's it for linear differential operators. Next time we're going to talk, first order differential operators. Next time we're going to talk about second order differential operators.